Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish the book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to. It feels a bit weird because the last episode that I did was just yesterday and I uploaded it yesterday, but this one, I'm recording it today because I read another quick read. Beforehand, I was reading this military science fiction book by Jason M. Huff, this Diet Earth Cycle, and I got through that, quite a bit of a page-turner. And then I had a book just on the Kindle app on my iPad. I wasn't listening to it as an audiobook because it's not available as an audiobook yet, but it's another very quick read. It's called Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, and which only came out a few months ago, like in October. So I'm doing some new releases to go along with some of these classics of science fiction or other books that I've read before. But this is a new book, and the reason I'm reading it is because there seems to be quite a lot of hype about it. Lots of people are going, oh, it's the best book that came out in 2013, and I see some blog posts about it. And then I was listening to an episode of the Incomparable podcast and their end of year book club or their winter reading book club, and someone said, yes, this is my favorite book of last year, and what we're going to do is we're going to do it as one of our read along or one of our book club episodes. So they did, and the latest episode of the maybe not the latest but one of the recent episodes of the Incomparable podcast, which is very good, and if you like movies and TV and general science fiction-y kind of stuff, they cover a lot of different things, not just books. In fact, very rarely books. Maybe like 1 in 10 episodes is books and the rest of it's movies and other science fiction-y fantasy kind of and, you know, comics and TV and all that kind of stuff. And they do a book club every now and then. But they decided to do 2 books. One of them was The Lies of Locke Lamora, which I've already read, and they talked a bit about that, and the follow-up, the sequels to that book by Scott Lynch, is it? And the other book that they're talking about in this episode was Ancillary Justice, and they started talking, I listened to all of the Lies of Locke Lamora one first, and I enjoyed their discussion of it, and then they were like, and now the next one, and they said, and first we'll set off the spoiler horn, and I was like, okay, I'm going to pause there. They didn't say anything about it, except one person said, it's my favourite book of last year, and someone else said, and I was like, it's interesting. So I have yet to go back and listen to the end of that episode, but I'm sure I'll do that tomorrow whenever I get a chance. I'm a bit busy with work over the next few days, but I'll get back to it. So Ancillary Justice, is it the best book that I read from last year? No, it's not. And while I did very much enjoy the experience of reading most of it, I felt let down quite a bit by by what happened at the end. Just so even if this comes across as a negative review, it just feels maybe I don't want it to come across too negative, but I want to explain why, after all of the hype, this book didn't really do it for me, even though there was quite a lot of stuff that I enjoyed about it. One thing that I didn't enjoy so much about it was that it got to the end of the book and I thought there was more of the book to go, and then they said, oh no, that's the last chapter, and now here's the thank yous or the dedication. The thank yous, afterwards acknowledgements, and then an afterwards where, hey, there is now an interview with the author, and now here's the first chapter of another book by Elizabeth Moon, I'm guessing another space opera kind of style of book from Elizabeth Moon. And that always catches me out because I'm always thinking, yeah, and I've got, I've got 20% of the book to go, or I'm at like 80% of the book, or 85% of the book, or 90% of the book. And then it just stops. And I've talked about this before on previous episodes. I think, what is it, episode 150, where I talked about reading science fiction or reading books, reading novels, where I go into what I like about ebooks and non-ebooks and paper books and audiobooks. And most often this kind of stuff that happens at the end of a book is just cut out of the audiobook. So generally when an audiobook says you've got 3 minutes remaining, you've got 3 minutes remaining. Whereas in paper books and ebooks, you kind of have to watch out for appendices and afterwards and things which take up a lot of time. So let's get into this. I made some notes as I was going through, and also some notes just a few minutes ago. I just finished this book today, so I've not really thought about it so much, but it seemed that all of the stuff that that kind of annoyed me about the book really crystallized as I was like reading that last chapter, and then it stops, and I was like, oh, really? Is that where it's going to go? But I decided to load up Goodreads and goodreads.com and check out what other people thought of it. So I read a few of some of these other reviews. It gets a 4.02 overall rating on Goodreads, and from SFBRP listeners, a 3.95 average rating, which are, like I say, SFBRP listeners, my friends. Like David Sven rated it 5 stars and Tamahomi 3 stars and other people 4 stars. You know, generally, oh, and Terp Kristen 2 stars. So I read through some of those reviews and then just general reviews from other people as well. So some of these points that I'll raise, I'll kind of, because I wanted to kind of see what other people really admired about this, and I'll touch on some of those points. So the setup is that we have like an empire, like a human empire spread across many star systems, and this empire is called the Radki or something. Maybe I should have continued listening to the other podcast to see how the guys on the Incomparable podcast pronounce it. But I'm saying the Radki. Anyway, so there's an empire called the Radki, and it's very expansionist, and they've been going for about 2,000 years or 3,000 years, but the main character has been alive in some form or another for 2,000 years. And these different ships invade or annex different planets and take them over, and what they do is, instead of killing the people who they're taking over, they take their bodies, and instead of killing them, they kind of blank their the minds of the people, and then not all the people, but all the troublemakers, they set the minds blank and then store them and freeze them, and then when they need extra bodies, they get them out, and these blank minds become ancillaries. And an ancillary is like part of a ship, which, again, I understand why people compare this to the Culture novels by Ian and Banks, because the ships have personalities, they're artificial intelligences, and they're run, they're kind of like the opposite of the ship minds in the Culture, though, because they are very much controlled by the humans. You know, when, if you have the right codes, you can control them completely, whereas the ship minds in the Culture are very free-ranging and do whatever they want to do. Or do whatever they feel is the best thing to do. But the ship minds in the Culture, they have ship avatars. And usually in the Culture, these are artificial bodies which they inhabit, or just even projections that go around the ship that humans can interact with. So they interact with ships on a human level. But sometimes in the Culture, it mentions, I think, I can't remember which book, but one of the later books, like Surface Detail, it talks about how some of these avatars are actually humans who volunteer their bodies to give their bodies across to the ship, so they have an interesting life being the ship avatar, and then at the end of a certain time, they get their own mind back, or they get control of their body back. So it's something which isn't completely new, but what I liked about this is that the vast majority of the crew on these ships throughout history, throughout these 2,000 years that this ship has been alive, the Justice of Torin is the one ship, most of the people, or most of the crew, are these ancillaries. And at the time this book is set, it's kind of going through a transition where there's going to be less ancillaries and more human crews, but, you know, each deck has a certain number. There's like Esk deck and Vor deck and Ob deck, and each of them have got crews, and the main character is or was once a ship, you know, depending if we do, there's different timelines. There's a backstory timeline and a current now timeline. In the backstory, the main character is called the Justice of Torin. It is a ship, but also the ship has got many different, like, groups of 20 ancillaries, and so sometimes the main character is one of these groups of 20 minds, but, like, at a distance, like down on a planet while the ship is up in orbit, and that is one Esk. Is this little, like, subgroup mind, and then one of the individual ancillaries sometimes takes over, and the main one is 19. So it's Justice of Torin, 1-esque 19 of the Radki, or the Radka, or Radshi Empire. Which is, yeah, kind of sometimes tricky to get your head around, but, you know, it's... But once someone says, oh, sometimes this character is the ship, and sometimes it's the group, and sometimes it's an individual, and most of the time it's an individual, but it once was a ship that was 2,000 years old, but now has been reduced down to just one of its ancillaries, and the ancillary is disconnected from the rest of the ship. Yeah, and that's what I say. Some of these views are saying, oh, this is a real mindfuck, and I can't work it out. But for me, it felt like a very natural, I would say, an extension of current science fiction trends or stuff that I read recently or over the last few years. But it's not even so much an extension. It's a clever way of doing that I've not seen before. And that was some of the parts that I enjoyed the most, were these backstory chapters where it talks about like how like this one character is in multiple different places, and you know, the point of view is just one point of view, but in different points around there. But this whole kind of like lots of minds being in one mind and seeing the same story from different points of view and then being recombined, it reminds me very much of just a book that I read recently, On the Steel Breeze by Alistair Reynolds. And there it's kind of split into different minds, you know, and the narration, one character's over here and then they're over there. And then when they join the minds back together again, then we get like the same, not the same story told from different point of views, but we get one person going, like I mentioned in the review of that, like they go, oh, you're my husband. And then they say the wrong name for the husband. It's like, oh, you know, see, that kind of stuff has been done. And also House of Sons, there's like a very, there's a similar thing going on there where one character clones themselves over and over and over again, sometimes in male bodies, sometimes in female bodies. And then every now and then, or at periodically, the clones get back together and share their brains and kind of reset the memories and stuff. And that kind of happens because the leader of this whole, the Radke empire, is called, I wrote the name down here, Ananda Mianai. There's lots of double A's in the name. And that's also a collective mind, which once again sets different, like, clones herself over and over. I think in the House of Suns, isn't it 1,000 clones or 10,000 clones? Similar kind of thing with Ananda Mianchi, long life spread across a galaxy. But then the whole idea of, like, a consciousness made up of lots of different minds and the view on that, it reminds me very much of Peter F. Hamilton. There's, like, in his Pandora Star book or the Judas and Chain book, I think it was in that one, where they have this, the minds, like these different minds are joined into a single personality. There's a plumber character and he's like, yes, and I'm here and here I am as well. And they go into a shop and start talking. This woman is doing up a house and she goes in and it's like, oh, and I'm the owner and I'm the owner and I'm the owner. We're all the same person. And she's like, oh, this is pretty special. I'll join in. And you get the funky love scenes that go on there as well. And also Morningstar Lake Mountain, or whatever the alien is called from that book. Again, lots of clones going over a hive mind, which does that kind of stuff. And I just realized that, like, time and time again, what I was reading in this book, I was just like, this feels like kind of warmed over tropes, well, not even tropes, but like ideas that I've read so much before in, you know, by Ian M. Banks. There's like a special gun. And I was like, well, she's going on a mission to find a special gun. Feels very much about like Against a Dark Background, which isn't a culture novel, but like a special gun does feel in that way that's the one of the main missions or one of the main parts of this book is tracking down this special gun. And then there's a ship saving its part of itself at one point. And I was like, I just read this. I'd read Accession just a few weeks ago. It feels very much like what happened there. You know, not exactly the same thing. And also some of these concepts feel very familiar to me due to my own writing. I do an extended bit about shared perception technology and people looking at themselves from different points of views and action going on, and you're seeing action from different points of views in my novel Combat and Broken Glass, which is part of the Minding Tomorrow trilogy, which you can read for free if you check it out on my website. So yeah, there's this basic setup where the Justice of Torin, or 1-esque, or Justice of Torin 1-esque 19, number 19, also passes herself off by the name of Breck. And the book is about Breck like facing her past and meeting up with people from her past. There's Saivadan Vendai, who is one of her old captains, and the book really begins. It's like, and I found this person in the ice, and I recognize this person, so I picked them up and saved them. Otherwise, they were going to freeze to death. And that's what kicks off the novel. And then there's a lot of stuff about the fallout of someone that, like a lieutenant that she was with, not a captain, but like down on this planet where they were annexing this planet, and there's this Lieutenant Orn, Orn, I'm guessing, and sort of other people that she's encountered in her past, generally not as an individual, but as a ship, is tracking them down. And of course, there's that whole point that nobody that she comes across knows that she is used to be one part of a ship mind, but now she is, and people treat her like an individual, even though she has to keep passing herself off. So that was one of my favorite parts, is this first part of this book. What else have I got here? The backdrop, like I said, is this empire, and there's this, and it's going through a transition where it's expanded out to where it can't easily expand out anymore. And I just was looking up, when I was reading this, I looked up and there was this map of, it's an old map, not going back to Roman times, but I kind of recognised, they keep expanding out until they run up against places which are too difficult to take over, or up against more powerful enemies that they want to face. Like, they keep on, like, the Romans went up through England, and then they got up to Scotland, and they're like, oh, maybe not, won't go that far. And then they got into Germany, went into the forest of Germany, and they kind of turn around and say, ah, maybe not that far. And they keep going further and further to the east, and they run up against the... you know, against the Chinese or the Mongol hordes, and they're like, oh, that's far enough out there, I don't need to go any further that way. And you feel like it's coming, like the expansionist part of the Roman Empire is being drawn to a close, and then it has to like change its political system and work out what it's going to do for an economy, and it's all based on slaves in the Roman Empire, and it's like, well, can we keep this up, and we've got to keep going, and not really quite sure what it's going to go. And it wasn't just that, there was a bit about the gods, about how and they have these religions, and it's all polytheistic religions, and that's what the Romans were famous for. They'd go, you've got some gods over here. Well, do you know that god that you have is actually our same god? That's Jupiter. Yeah, you think that you're going with you know, whatever the god is, and I'm just thinking back to my asterisks and obelisk reading days, and all the by Jupiter, by Jove, and all these things are all the same gods in the end. And that's what you have here. And of course, when I read the afterwards, there was an interview with the author, and it's like, yes, and I didn't want it to be too much like the Roman Empire. And I was like, well, it was kind of, you were kind of wearing that on your sleeve a little bit, which is another thing that some of the characters do, literally wearing stuff on their sleeves. But there it is. That's the kind of backdrop. Let me look next in the notes. Yes, that's kind of stuff. Another thing that I quite liked, oh, just in general, I actually really like the world building, because the characters are always described in where they fit in the world, which I'll get onto a bit more in a minute. But the main character, our protagonist, is a ship. She's not a real human. So when she meets people, she kind of sees them as a function of what they are in society. It's not always, this person is tall and blonde and with a heavy-set face and strong and doing this. It's all like, this person uses this language and I have to interact with them in this way and I don't want to insult them by saying this. You know, everyone is kind of talked about in terms of world-building I enjoyed that, but it's almost to a fault where I actually wanted a little bit more description about people. But it's like this character, this Breck or Justice of Torren, Department 1-esque person 19 doesn't see people as people. They see them as you know, units in a wider society. So it's good and bad. The other thing that Breck or the ship can't do is tell what gender someone is. Can't tell if they're male or female. And all of the characters are human, because it's suggested that the humanity is spread to the stars. And then this is one new empire that is spreading out and taking over all human worlds. So everyone is a human, even though it keeps saying, oh, and I'm never quite sure if someone wears a dress in this thing, if someone has long hair or short hair, like the cues, the social cues changes all the time. And I'm never quite sure if I'm seeing someone male or female. Because in the, the Radka Empire, they don't have gendered pronouns, and it's never explained exactly why not, but everyone is just referred to in this book as a she when referred to in the language of the Radka, or by anyone who lives by that point of view, like Breck, our protagonist. This part of the ship's mind always sees people as a she, or that's the pronoun that they take. And again, I wasn't quite sure the reason why. Maybe it's just like, in the future we don't care about gender anymore, it doesn't matter anything, and we're all blind to gender. I think that's part of it, but my own reading, which might have been in the book, but I can't remember, is that the emperor of this empire, or the person in charge, which I will look up the name again, is called the Ananda Mianai, is said to is a collective mind, said to replicate herself, like clone herself, over and over again, and it's always referred to as a her. But I'm thinking that at one point, this person, when they were just one person or this one figure, was once just a male or just a female, but then cloned itself enough into so many different bodies, both male and female, that language kind of evolved from the kind of a top-down thing that nobody ever wanted to refer to this leader as either a he or a she, it just became, well, I'm just going to pick a she, and that's going to be the default. That's the default that's being used by the author and Lecky. But in the real world, there is just, like, hey you, rather than hey him or her or she or anything like that. It's just a hey you kind of thing. And that kind of came down from the top down as a way not to offend the supreme leader. And it kind of went down from there, further and further down, and sort of filtered down throughout society. So then, like, 3,000 years later, or however long it takes, nobody ever references it or even sees it. It's just not part. Even though it seems that there are still males and females, there must be dangly bits and other bits. I was going to say, what do women have which aren't dangly bits? Non-dangly bits. Whatever. They have different droopy bits in other places. I mean, these things must be there, and it's kind of explained, oh yeah, we just find someone, like, if we want, if it's like male and male, or a he and a he and a she and a she, even though they don't look at it this way, and we want kids, we just find a way to make kids. We just, you know, we'll work it out. We'll have, like, surrogate mother or father or whatever we need to have kids. We'll just do that and continue on our families. They have these family dynasties which go on, and people are bred and live for hundreds of years and become more powerful, and the houses interact in different ways, which is pretty cool too. Don't need to talk too much about that, but that's it there. So this book, again, lots of people are saying, oh, this is really great and it's really difficult. I read some of these reviews. Oh, it's really confusing that none of these characters, you don't know if they're male or female or not. And I was just like, well, again, going back to Ian M. Banks, like, yeah, but didn't we just do that when we were reading Player of Games? He says, well, the culture doesn't have male and female pronouns, even though, like I say, in the book, the author decides if someone's going to be male or female, although in the culture they can flip backwards and forwards between them. So it's like the gender distinction isn't meaningful in that someone can just choose their gender at will, rather than other people having to be gender blind. And other people don't have a gender. I think there's some of the non-culture people who are, like, not eunuchs, but they're not male or female. And then, like, the Azad Empire is, they have, like, three genders, and there's just an aside by the narrator who just says, I'm just going to pick, like, in your language, male is higher status, so we're going to use that as the higher status and female's lower status, and the mid one as a, well, whichever, if they're going to be male or female. Oh, no, that's it. It's just like the middle gender. Sometimes they'll be referred to as a he or if a she, depending on the tendencies that they display. But then I was just reading, like, again, once again, on the Steel Breeze, and there's a character who isn't male or female, or maybe they are male or female, but it's just assumed by Alistair Reynolds that it's going to be, sometimes it's going to say V did this, sometimes it belonged to Ver, so it could be she did this, or her, it belonged to her, or he, you know, it belonged to Vim instead of him. And it's like an extra different personal pronoun there. And it's just one character in that whole book. But and I mentioned that in my review, it's just the way that it wasn't even mentioned. It just became part of the backdrop. It just became part of the world. It wasn't so much about part of the story. It wasn't a factor in the story in the same way that it was only barely mentioned that the main character was from Africa and spoke Swahili and Portuguese rather than being a white male character from Europe speaking English. You know, it was just part of the world that made the world a bit more rich. And in this book, I didn't find it tricky, I think partly because I'd just been trained by Alistair Reynolds, and that book is a recent book. So, like I say, this book feels very modern, but it doesn't feel, to me, it doesn't feel groundbreaking, but mainly because, like I say, I've had tasters of these other elements and these other ideas with all these other science fiction books that I've been reading over the past, you know, just even the past few months, I feel the same themes coming back again. What else have I got here? Put this way, like, what I liked about this is that the main character doesn't see gender, but other people do, and there's a bit of an interplay there. It's like, oh, is this a he or a she? I'm not quite sure, and if I say she, I'm going to offend them, or if I say he, I'm going to offend them, and this person is a young person, so I don't need to worry, I'll just call you, like, a do. You'll just be like a genderless, I don't need to use a gendered pronoun for that anyway. And I enjoyed that part, and there's, like, and I understand that it works in this book because the main character is a ship and there isn't going to be a love interest. And normally when a character turns up in these books, you're like, ah, and that's going to be the love interest because they're the right age and the right size and the right shape or the right species and the right gender. and they turn up. And but here, because the main character is a love interest, that's not an issue. I'm thinking it might be become an issue in the later books, because this is actually the first book in a trilogy, which I didn't realize, but of course it is, because it's a modern science fiction book, so it's probably going to be the first book in a trilogy. That might come up in the future, but it felt really kind of refreshing that when a character comes along, I don't have to think, oh, this is going to be a love interest. It's just like, no, these characters, it's just like a closeness that develops just because it's a friendship. I don't need to worry about it. And when other characters get together and there is a love interest, like, we're not told if it's, you know, biologically a male and a female. It's just, this is a she and a she, even though that's just the chosen personal pronoun by Anne Leckie as the author. That's not how the main character, Breck, views people, and that's not how they view each other's. It's just like, there is a love story, and I guess they're compatible. They get together, and, you know, it could be man and man, and man and woman. It doesn't really matter, and that's what I like. Unfortunately, after all of that stuff that I like about it, put it this way, I want more books to be like this. I really enjoy reading about characters where I don't know if it's male or female. And it's kind of really refreshing in that way. It's like, this is this character. And it's just like, yes, we need that non-specific personal pronoun. Alistair Reynolds did a V and a Ver. And I think, thinking back to the Left Hand of Darkness, Ursula K. Le Guin did something, you know, similar there. I can't remember if she just used a he, but made it very clear that it wasn't a he, like always reminding us that's what the book is about. Always reminding us, no, it's not a he and it's not a she, it's non-gendered. And in this, and like I say, the Ver and the V with... These other books, by Alistair Reynolds, I think I just mentioned that as well. But like I say, I want more books like that. However, in this book, it doesn't really do anything special with it. Just like, it just goes, oh, this is just the state of things, but that's not what this book is about. But for a book which uses it so prominently, that this whole story could have happened with that not being a factor, and just everyone could have been just male or female. Which isn't what I want, but it felt kind of a bit wasted. I'm thinking, well, maybe we'll have more about this in the future. But, like, the society is so set up with this, and the person is so ingrained in the society for that. For them, it's normal. And for us, then it just becomes normal. And it just felt like a gimmick, a trick. And I don't want it to be a gimmick or a trick. It either needs to feel completely natural, like it did with the character in On the Steel Breeze by Alistair Reynolds, but that was just one character, so it was just a little thing that as you were going, like, ah, that's always makes the character a little bit more interesting. But here, it didn't feel like it was making the characters more interesting. And actually, kind of, not, it wasn't just a missed opportunity to talk more about gender, but it kind of, again, made it difficult to know what people look like, because there was nothing for me to catch hold of. There wasn't like, oh, and their hair was this color and the face looked like this and had a feminine face or looked like a man. Was it really a man? It was never like, oh, this person has long hair and has a narrower face and is slightly more lightweight, and but they're not wearing a dress, they're wearing like overalls, so I'm not quite sure if it's a male or a female. We never got that view. It was always just like, here is a person, and now here is their function in the plot, or here is a person, and this is the connection that I'm going to use to them to explain more about the world. And I thought, like I say, it made the characters not more difficult to stand out, because they're, like I say, their characters and their functions made them stand out, and that wasn't really a problem so much, but it would have been nice to actually use this, like, this character, like, when she needed to look at someone and say something in another language where she had to say either he or she, that would have been an opportunity for Breck to then describe to us, the reader, what the person looked like, but it felt so often that was just skipped over, to the detriment. So, the setting, it felt quite generically space opera-y in some ways. Like, for example, they go to a space station and there's a big temple on it, but I never really understood the size or the shape of the space station, and there's these ships, and we were never really described the shape of the ships. They were just like, well, there's this deck, and there's this deck, there's like 10 decks, and the bottom 5 decks are empty, but not really you know, of course, the character is a ship. So it's not like when we meet a human being and are introduced to a human being, it's like, and this person has, well, humans, you know, they have 2 feet and then 2 legs and a body and 2 arms and a head and they have hair on the top of the head. You know, we don't describe stuff from, like, in that way. So I understand that when Breck, who is a ship, goes on board a ship, they aren't going to go, oh, and it's very important for me for now to describe this ship. But yet again, it felt like missing a chance there to really, you know, have some real description of what's going on. So yeah, kind of generic. Oh, there's some very not interesting planets that they go to. It seems like the attributes of these two different planets that all of the books are set up, because they get these backstory chapters and these current day chapters, and they switch between each other, and one of them is very, very cold, and one of them is hot and muggy, and people don't have any walls because they need air to get into the house. And it felt like, to me, I mean, it was nice that, like, the two places were different. One was hot and one was cold, so we could tell where we were going, like, when we were switching between them, and if it ever mentioned houses without walls, I knew I was in one place, and if it mentioned anything cold or someone not going outside and having to, you know, put a jacket on, it was handy to be able to tell the difference, but otherwise felt rather unremarkable. Both of those places felt unremarkable, and their differences felt like more of a help towards the plot rather than any real reason for them to be different, except, of course, one person needed to be found in the snow, otherwise they'd die. But that person could easily have been found in a desert and had to be saved, otherwise they'd die of heat or dehydration rather than just dying of cold. And there's this bridge, they go to an alien thing, and it's just not very interesting because, I mean, it could be interesting. It's like, oh, this glass bridge made out of thing and it's going across this big chasm. And I'm like, but yeah, I read Absolution Gap by Alistair Reynolds, and I've read just way better by Ian M. Banks. And so, again, I didn't, in any of the reviews, I didn't read anyone saying, oh, this is really important. Someone did say, ah, it's really cold, a bit like In the Left Hand of Darkness. And I also noticed that when I was reading the book. I wasn't going to mention it in the review because it kind of feels a bit obvious in some way. But yeah, like, after reading, you know, reading this book in the middle of an Ian M. Banks culture reading, culture series reading book club thing, it just never really got up. When I wanted a big bit of alien leftover technology, a glass bridge over a chasm, yeah, you got to try a bit harder than that these days, especially if people are comparing your work to Ian M. Banks. You've got to at least match the least imaginative alien artifact that is ever described by Ian Banks, at least match his least imaginative one with your best and only big bit of alien technology or alien culture or bit of, you know, leftover alien technology. And which brings me to the technology in the book, which is pretty variable, I would say. And, like, there's an alien thing that comes up, an alien gun, great. But it's kind of magical and I don't understand. It's not really explained very much. It's a magical alien gun, great. But that's all we have some other aliens that one turns up, which is called the rrr. It's just lots of rrr. And when a book, there's a book which actually inspired me to start off the SFBRP, which is The Swarm by Frank Schätzing, and it was such a bad book, and I wanted to rant about it, but I had nobody to rant about this book too. And one of the things that I really disliked about that is, like, oh, we've got to name this alien thing, and someone just, like, spills something and, like, hits some keys randomly on the keyboard, and they call the alien the Yurr. It's a Y-R-R-R or something like that. It's the Yurr, and we're going to pronounce it Yurr. And then I read in this book, the alien is called the Rrr, and I'm just like, don't remind me of The Swarm by Frank Schätzing. That's a really bad thing to happen in your book. Even if it's playful, you can't just go, let's call them the Rrr, because they sound like they go grrr all the time, so we'll call them Rrr. Yeah, in some ways, the book was variable. This is what I wanted to say, actually. This is my note here. Is that the technology that the humans use in some ways feels advanced, like they have these ancillaries, the humans all keyed into each other, these blank minds that they take over, and it feels like a lot of their technology or a lot of the progress that has taken place relies on this, what is, you know, zombie slave labor, mind slaved human people. And it says, oh, and we went along here and I would always do this and I would fix this thing and I would do this and do that, lots of minds looking after the very few humans, and then when the humans have to look after things, they don't do such a good job. And that's, I'll get onto that because that's one of the main themes of the book later on. But it felt like sometimes you're like, well, the humans have faster than light travel going through wormholes. They have shields. They have artificial gravity. They have this and they have that. But then something will come up and they're like, oh, and then they have a gun with a bullet. And I was like, really? Guns with bullets? We have faster than light travel. We have all this kind of stuff. What about the lasers? But it's not even mentioned. And at one point it was like, oh, and I needed to remove this door. And so I removed the door. And it's like, you can't just remove a door. Can you just remove a door in a like an airlock? And this is the ship which can go faster than light, and it's got these shuttles going around. And while, like, while something like Ian M. Banks just goes, oh, anything's possible, fields, mines, stupid stuff going on, plasma, whatever, just have everything. And then on the other end of that spectrum could be, like Alistair Reynolds is saying, okay, everything, you can't have faster than light technology, you can't have artificial gravity, we have to keep stuff, you know, as it is now, so there isn't going to be any plasma rifle or whatever, you know, all that kind of stuff is just out the window. And it feels more grounded, whereas this, it, like, sometimes it felt super advanced, and sometimes it felt like, are we actually in the Roman Empire? Is everything just relying on, you know, brute force and slave labor? So, yeah, I think that could have been tackled a bit better, I think. Otherwise, like I say, just technologically, like the big world building stuff, like we have to have cloned minds or slaved minds, and we have to have clones, and we have to have faster than light. It kind of felt cop out space opera. It's like faster than light. Of course we have to have faster than light. Otherwise it's going to take too long to move around. But it didn't feel like the work had been put into the wormholes or the faster than light travel, like someone like Peter F. Hamilton will do. He'll construct an entire, you know, civilization around wormholes or faster than light technology, and it'll be like a fundamental part of the world building. Whereas here, it felt like a convenient part of the world building. Before I get onto the actual thing that the main letdown, another thing that let me down was the action scenes and the way that tension was built up. And it like the whole book is like, I want to find this gun so I can shoot this person. But then all of the other action scenes were like, I am in this room with this person and I'm going to get out a gun and shoot this person. And if I don't have a gun, I will get someone for a gun. And when the gun arrives, I will shoot this person. And now for some variety, I will not be in the same room. I will be in a different room and I will punch someone. And now I am in a room and I will shoot somebody. And like, and now I'm not in a room, I am in a spaceship and I will shoot somebody. It's like all of the tension was built up and all of the action scenes came out as in someone drawing a gun, pointing at someone else and shooting. And like who they might point the gun at created some tension. And the reasons that they wanted to point the gun at also created tension. And if they would actually go through with it and pull the gun out and shoot them also created tension. But like the punchline to all tension building and all drama was pulling out a gun and shooting somebody. Which brings me to my main thing that where this book let me down. These other criticisms could all be forgiven if the story paid off in a big way. And I thought the story was going to pay off in a big way. It started really good. We have these alternating chapters, one set in the current day or whatever it's going to say, and one set 20 years before as part of a backstory. And someone has gone, like someone, you know, this Breck, like from what happened in 20 years ago, set in motion this plan in 20 years in the planning and tracking down. She wants to find this gun to fulfill a mission, to take revenge. So it's like a revenge story. And up until about 2/3 of the way through the book, which I thought was actually further into the book, but like I say, there's that, it kind of cut off before we got to the end, which I'll get to in a second. But we're flitting backwards and forwards, and I was like, yeah, this is really good. There's lots of really good stuff. And then halfway through the book, or like 2/3 of the way through the book, suddenly it goes, oh, and that's what happened at the end of the backstory, and now we're caught up, and now let's continue with our story in the present day with our character. And suddenly, like, all of the tension, well, not all of the tension went, but it's sort of like, okay, and now that's it. Great. So you've got what you need to do. You're going to the right place that you want to do. Now you just need to do the thing that you want to do. And they get to the place, this space station, and suddenly it's like, ah, and now you've got to have this interview, and now you've got to have this check, and now you've got to meet these people, and now you've got to have these conversations over here, and now you've got to make an appointment, and then you've got to do this, and the appointment might take a week to go through, it might take months to go through. And so suddenly, at the one point in the book where I was like, oh yeah, now the action's really going to start ramping up, because we've got all the pieces in place, we know all the players, we know all the characters, we're going to have all the everything's all identified, everything's together. And yeah, and then it's really going to pick up and it's going to go through and it's going to be big action in the end. But it isn't. It just like really slows down. And then out of nowhere, the end confrontation picks up, which is, like I say, once again, somewhere, and start shooting with a gun. And like, who are they going to shoot at? What's going to happen? And then it just kind of just fizzles out. And that was my update on Goodreads when I was like 80% of the way through or 75% of the way through. Do I actually have that page open? Let me have it here. Yeah, I said, it doesn't come up. But anyway, I say, I'm 75. Oh, it's actually on this page. Yeah, I'm 75% done with Ancillary Justice. Slowed down a bit. I hope it's ramping up to a big ending. It just doesn't. Actually, exactly what I just said. I'm being a bit redundant here. I guess I'm being a bit redundant. So that's was a huge, huge letdown. And then after the end of the book, what happens is then we get, like, it's not really an epilogue, but then it's like, and now what happened after the big showdown? This happened, and then this person came out of hospital, and then this person did this, and now let's meet up with this, and what's this person doing over here? Well, I guess we've got to do this, and what are you going to do now that you've completed your mission? Oh, I'm going to go and do this, and then you've got to do this. And in my last review, if you listen to my last episode, I kind of let down a bit by the end of the Dire Earth Cycle by Jason M. Hoff is that at the end of the Plague Forge, he goes, and then everything comes together and we get all the answers and that's it. And then it's like an epilogue in just like like a 2-page or 3-page epilogue just goes, and these are all the answers and this is what these characters are getting. They're all heading off in that direction and I'm staying here, the end. And I was like, well, what would happen if all of that took place in action? And what I have in Ancillary Justice is the answer. What you have is a drawn-out, not very satisfying setup to the next story, in this case, in the trilogy. And I'm so glad that Jason M. Huff didn't do that, because it's just like this really blatant, and now we set up the motivations for the characters for what they're going to do in the next story, and I'm going to do it all by long conversations between characters who talk about each other and say each other, and you're going to go over there, am I? Yes, I'm going to go over here, and what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to go over here and do this, and we got to do this to do, and we're going to set up here, because, you know, this whole, you know, stuff is kicking off across the empire, the Radka Empire, the Radka sphere of influence with the, you know, interactions with aliens, and we've got to go and sort this out over here. And I was just like, that didn't need to be there. What the best point would have been, like, there's a perfect cutoff at the point, and a little bit of, like a five-word epilogue, or five-line, or five-paragraph epilogue. That's all you need. It's like, and then they woke up in hospital and opened their eyes, and this person was standing there. It's like, yes, all we need to know is you don't need to leave us on a cliffhanger of who survived into the next book. But it should be the next book's job to set up the story for the next book, not this book. I don't want, like, it would have been a self-contained story if it had ended before the last chapter. But the last chapter just brought it down. I was already a bit disappointed by the, you know, by the lack of the satisfying resolution to the whole thing, and then it was even more of a letdown. So I have more admiration for Jason M. Huff, who obviously had written all of that, and is just like, actually, that's not the important thing. I just need to finish this story. This point of the book should not be a setup for the next story. Excuse me, I'm just gonna have a quick glass of water, or a sip from my glass of water. So the other reason why this book didn't pick up for me at all is that the whole end of the book was too easy for Breck, was too easy for Justice of Torin, Esq. 1, number 19. There's this kind of thing in the religion of the Radke religion, which is like, ah, everything happens for a reason. There's no such thing as coincidence. Which could make an interesting start to the story. Like, oh, there's a big coincidence here at the start of the story. However, that big coincidence that starts, that kicks off the story, literally, the one character finds another character, and they have a connection with them in the past. And I was like, well, that's quite handy. I bet that's going to come in handy later on in the book. And I bet that's got a lot of meaning, that character happened to be in that place at that time when our main character, our protagonist, is going to go there. And I was like, that's going to be super meaningful at some point. There's going to be a reason why they were in that place. Nope, no reason. Just happened to be there. Just a coincidence. But there's no such thing as a coincidence. Ah, oh, you just meet someone from your past very handily. Ah, oh, that is very handy. And I'm just like, okay, that's good. But what happens, like, how can that Like, how can tension, or like, how can I believe that this is a big universe when that same thing happens another three, like, at least another three times, where she meets someone and it's like, hey, you're that person from my past, and that's going to be really handy in this way. And I'm like, wow, that's really convenient, that person. And hey, you're this person from my past as well. And I'm like, wow, that's really convenient as well. And you're my person from the past. Now, I wouldn't mind this if this was like a main theme of the book. Oh, and coincidences. There is no such thing as a coincidence. You will find this thing. If you've lived like 2,000 years, like the main character has, you're going to meet people from your past. But that can't be what drives the action, which means that it's like too convenient that the main character just goes in and I need to be somewhere and I do, and I need to be somewhere here and I succeed. It's like, oh, I need some help in this place. Oh, look over here, someone that I just helped two chapters ago just happens to be here.
Excuse me, phone call. Hello, Luke Burridge. Hey, no CDs to sell. Okay,
wondering if I sell CDs after my show. Juggling doesn't make very good CDs. So yeah, like if you just meet someone and you help them out, and then you just happen to meet them again, and they just turn up, and then they help you, and then a bit later, they just happen to turn up again, and they help you again, and then someone else from your past, it's just constantly just people keep turning up again. I was like, is this like a thematic thing? If it is, it makes it very unsatisfying. I want to see someone actually have to work for something, rather than any time that they need some help at any point to go on, someone from their either recent past, you know, recent past, 20-year past, or 1,000-year-ago past, just turns up again. It kind of made me feel like there's only like 20 people in the whole galaxy. And what was I going to say here? Ending, keep story... Oh yeah, I've already talked about this over. Like, the ending, keep the story past the end, explaining mysteries by conversation, versus an epilogue, or versus just stopping. And in this case, I think Anne Leckie picked the least satisfying ending. What was, I'm sure there was another one that I had here. No, I guess those are my plotting and story criticisms overall. And it was so good. I was really enjoying this book up until, like, as we kept on going backwards and forwards from the chapters. And I know I'm in a minority here, because I read another review and it's like, oh, as we were flicking backwards and forwards from between chapters, it was really confusing. But then once the storylines came together and it was just all the way through to the end, that's when it really picked up. For me, it's the opposite. So I understand that some people enjoy alternating chapters and going backwards and forwards through time and meeting characters at different points of their life. But, like, again, I just read Player of Games by Ian Banks, and everyone's making the comparisons, and there are comparisons, clear comparisons that you can draw between this and the Culture series. But once again, like, it just, this book just falls so far short. Like, again, Player of Games is not Player of Games, Use of Weapons is one of my favorite science fiction books of all times. But when you're going so close to it that you have like a character from the past who wants revenge or wants to meet someone, is going back and like trying to get hold of people from the past, and you know, go up against this and has to fight in different ways and invades people and takes over plans, it's like the comparisons are there, but you need to do better. Two other things which I just got to bring up here, which is when I say don't remind me of bad books, is that this book also reminds me of Way of the Kings by Brandon Sanderson, for two ways. One of them is that people have to wear gloves, because if their hand is in the open, it's unclean for some reason, and they have to wear gloves, which reminds me about, oh, I have to use my left hand instead of my right hand for different things. That's in the Way of the Kings, which also brings up one of my complaints about Way of Kings. The Way of Kings? Way of the Kings? By Brandon Sanderson, is the swearing in it. It's like, everyone's like, oh, storm you, and storm off, and storm this, and storm that. And it kind of, like, maybe because Brandon Sanderson is a Mormon, he's a good guy, he doesn't swear a lot, he doesn't understand swearing, but it felt like, you realise that when you swear, something has to be forbidden, it has to be naughty, you shouldn't be able to say it normally, so it has to be something, was it profane? It has to be scatological or sexual or, you know, heretical in some way, that you know, take the Lord's name in vain and all that kind of stuff. And here, there's this god, which, and there's sort of like, I think it's Attu or something, it's like, Attu's tits. And it seems weird that pointing out the tits of something, the breasts of something, in a society where breasts are not important, or they're not a marker of something They're not a marker of sexual attraction or gender distinction, or maybe they are, but it's weird that in this book where tits are something which aren't even mentioned, even the gender, they're not even used as a signifier. It even says it's difficult to tell if someone's a male or female because in some places people can be curvy and that means they're male. In other places they can be curvy and that means they're female. And then tits is a thing that's there. And I was like, just take the clean hand stuff. If you're going to do a swear word, like the hands, like, you know, I'll come over then slap you with my bare hand. Oh, you know, I don't know, but it's not my job to come up with this. It's Anne Leckie's job to come up with more convincing swearing. So finally, talking about the themes, there are some stuff going on there. Like I say, the gender identification, the gender or the genderless pronouns and stuff is interesting, but like kind of a wasted opportunity. One of the things that I really enjoy most about this book is talking about the empire and how the empire expands. And I mentioned it before that sometimes the slaves are better than humans at stuff. And I really like the ambiguity where people, like our main character is one of these, you know, these ancillaries, these blanked mind humans. And it's horrific that this mind has been blanked, but it's kind of hinted at one point when the doctor says, hey, I can bring out the mind that's been suppressed in there, and I can bring out your old, the real personality back. So these people aren't killed, but they're taken over and used and then disposed of. They're kind of like disposable parts and they're frozen. So they're not killed. So when people come down to a planet, like when the planet has been invaded and annexed or whatever the term is, like, lots of people are taken over with minds, which is horrific. But if those people hadn't been taken over as, you know, by the ship's AIs and, you know, taken over by the Radke as ancillaries, they would just be killed. And what's more horrific, being killed or their mind being taken over? It's like, it's equivalent in many ways. And when their minds are taken over and if they're not used, they're just destroyed anyway, which is as good as being killed. But then the people who have been taken over are like, oh, actually, we prefer when you take our disruptive troublemakers and blank their minds and then you take them away and then you use other ones from storage and they come down. And we prefer the zombie AI ship people because they're in control. They don't massacre us. They don't, you know, there's no public degradation. They look at us as though we're real people, as though we're citizens, because we are citizens. Like, you know, all of the subjects of Rome can become Roman citizens. It's a similar kind of thing. Well, it's kind of exactly the same kind of thing in this book. And the ship ancillaries aren't racist and they aren't prejudiced in any way. And we see that over and over again, that actually for the people who are being taken over, this is actually better. But like the whole thing is in this transition point from, okay, ship ancillaries running things and doing everything, and slowly humans are coming in and taking that job. And in some ways, you know, it's like that I read a story once and they trained some pigeons to do a job that humans used to be able to do. And they're like, well, we can't train pigeons to do it because we're training these pigeons just to peck there and get food back. And we're not paying the pigeons. I think it was like to tell the different colors on a pill or something, to sort pills or to do quality control on pills. And they said, no, that's inhumane to train pigeons to do that kind of work. We have to put humans back to do that work. And you're like, but isn't it more inhumane to have a human looking at those pills and just pressing buttons as the pills come past to do the quality control when a pigeon can do it? And it's one of those things that, like, if it's more humane for a human not to be doing that job, like, is it okay for an animal to do that, or a non-human human body, or non-human mind human body? And it's that kind of thing that I really liked. That's the kind of discussion that I really liked. And that's what the whole drama, that's what the whole tension in the whole empire is based around at the moment. It's like, we need to stop doing this. We need to stop taking over these planets and taking over the brains and all that kind of stuff. But is that the humane future, or is the humane future the one where nobody is a slave, but everybody has to work hard? Whereas before they wouldn't have had to work hard, but now there's no source of free slaves anymore. Everybody's got to start working. And I'm taking it a bit too far, but it feels like a kind of almost a political statement, or it feels like it has relevance to the modern world, where it's like, well, there's no slaves in, you know, in the modern world anymore, but are paying people below minimum wage, or even if there's no minimum wage, like in Germany, there's no minimum wage. I think there's one coming up, but it's like, what's, you know, what is the benefits that we, you know, like, even though someone isn't a slave, is it better if those slaves aren't humans, and if they're not actually suffering anyway, if their life is better. Because, you know, our main character, she's like singing, and this group of, you know, Esk-1 from this Justice of Torin, like singing, and it's kind of like got a personality, and the ship seems very happy, and the ship has friendships and all that kind of stuff. It seems like a very happy system if you just ignore the horrific setup of the whole thing. And that's what I like about this. I don't want to come down one way or the other, because it feels like the book doesn't come down one way or another on this issue of not is slavery good, but like one system has benefits and drawbacks for everyone, and another system has benefits and drawbacks for everyone, and some systems are horrific for some people and some less horrific for those same people but more horrific for these others. There's a balance to be struck, and I feel like that's what this book is going to be going into, and it felt that's what this book is going to be. And then the last chapter of this book kind of let it all down. It's like, oh no, and now forget that ambiguity, we're the good guys and we're going off there, and one character's going, eh, really? But all the rest was like, no, yeah, let's go over here. And it felt like a bit of a cop-out at the end. It's like, no, really, there are good guys and bad guys, even though the main character was like, there's no good guys and bad guys, I'm doing this thing and that kind of thing. Oh, and also, oh no, I don't want to give spoilers, but I was going to go into another reason why the ending of the book was a bit unsatisfying. It mainly goes to the point was wanting a lot of revenge and then kind of settling for something a lot less, which I don't want to get into. But that's kind of set up throughout the book. So I'm just going to give this... I tried to clear this up at the beginning. It feels like I've been ragging on this book a lot and talking down at it. I just wanted to explain that it is a good book. It is worth reading. I almost want to say stop reading halfway through when the timelines catch up together, because after that, but some, like I say, I read some of the reviews. Some people really struggled through that first part and then it picked up for them. For me, it's the opposite way around. And I would also say stop reading at the most obvious point, which you think this is the end of it, the character's done everything. Stop reading there and maybe read the last chapter when you pick up book two, which is probably coming out this year or next year. Actually, let's have a look. I have the Wikipedia page open for Anne Leckie. Forthcoming October 2014. So it looks like on a yearly release. And I wish it was a monthly release. It's one of those books where, like I say, if I could just now read the next one, because the first one came in October and the next one in November and the next one in December, if I could just read the next one, I probably would. I'd just carry on reading through. But now I've got to wait a whole year, or, you know, until October to read the second one. I probably won't read it. I'll probably wait 2 years until there's Ancillary Justice, then Ancillary Sword and Ancillary Mercy when the third one comes out. And if people say, yeah, it's worth reading through to the end, I probably will. But otherwise, not going to go through it now. So yeah, I'm going to give this 3.5 stars. And it's a real pity, because up until about halfway through this, I was thinking this was going to be a 5-star book, but it really dropped off in that second part for me. So that's it for this book. Next book that I'm going to be reading and reviewing is probably going to be the next culture book, which is going to be State of the Art, which I've got some audiobooks and ebook versions and audiobooks and audio drama version from State of the Art, which I think if you search online, you'll be able to find the audiobook version. No, the audio drama version from the BBC. It's actually, I've listened to it before. It's good fun. It's actually quite a fun introduction to the culture if you've not listened to it, if you've not read any culture before. But I wouldn't suggest starting there. But if you want an hour-long introduction to the culture, it's a good place to start. But I would suggest just reading Player of Games first. So, what else? Yeah, you can email me, luke@juggler.net. The best thing to do is join in the discussion about this book on Goodreads. You can become my friend on goodreads.com and discuss this right there on the review. You can join in with the SFBRP listener group. We're checking out, what's the discussion at the moment? Books I would like to see reviewed. Talking about World War Z at the moment, or World War Z, which I watched as a movie but didn't complete the book. A bit of discussion going on there. For that, you can you can read my own fiction at lukeburge.com. You can follow me on Twitter. Or did I say that already? I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. Otherwise, that's it for me. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time.